Good evening, everyone. Hello, and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on what to eat. This is our 80th episode. Nutrition and diet are a popular topic in Cure Talks. And today, we once again attempt to tackle the question of what we should eat to stay healthy. Specifically, the issue of animal products. To do so, we have with us two very distinguished panelists. Dr. Colin Campbell is a Jacob Gold Schurman Professor Emeritus of Nutritional Biochemistry in the Division of Nutritional Sciences at Cornell University and a best-selling author. His first book, The China Study, examines the relationship between chronic illness and the consumption of animal products. His new book, Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition, poses serious problems with the way nutritional research is conducted. We also have with us clinical nutritionist, Dr. Kyla Daniels, who serves on the board of directors of the Western A. Price Foundation and Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. World, which discusses the healing properties of animal fats for everything from digestion to inflammation. My co-host of the evening is Julie DeLute. Julie is a professional writer. She's been writing professionally for over 15 years, both as a journalist and as an advertising copywriter. As someone who's experimented with veganism, raw food, juice, and water fasting, as well as GAPs and paleo diets, she is well-versed to be moderating the discussion today. Towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions sent in via email by our listeners. If you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Welcome to the show, everyone. We are what we eat, but what do we eat? Should we be eating meat? If so, how much meat? Or is a plant-based diet a healthier way of eating? Although Dr. Campbell and Dr. Daniel come from opposing schools of thought, our goal today is to uncover some areas of convergence. With that, I now hand over to Julie to begin with the discussion. Julie, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya. Welcome, Dr. Campbell. And is it Dr. Daniel or Dr. Daniel?
Dr. Daniel.
Dr. Daniel. Wanted to make sure I get that right.
Thank you.
Well, you should both know that I have a juicer and a Vitamix sitting on my kitchen counter, but I also have homemade bison broth and grass-fed liverwurst in my freezer. So it's truly an honor to be here with you both. We'll get started right away. People who are familiar with your work know that there's a lot that you two disagree on. But for those who aren't familiar, can you give us each a short summary of what you consider to be the key principles of a health-promoting diet? Dr. Campbell, we'll start with you. What did you learn from the China Study?
Well, the China Study, first off, is a book. It discussing a broad array of topics and research that I did for over 45 years. The China Study itself, that project, that's only one part of it. But what we learned when we looked at the totality of the data, not just the China Study, that was only one part of it. What we learned was that the closer we get to consuming a whole food, plant-based diet, the healthier we're going to be on a variety of illnesses that might otherwise occur.
And by whole food, are you specifically referring to plant-based foods or just any food in its whole form?
Yes, I'm sorry, I meant to say a whole food plant-based diet, vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, and so forth. Yes,
yep.
And by
okay.
whole, I mean, for the most part, intact foods, you know, rather than just taking out the sugar or the fat or something like that.
And Dr. Daniel, what is a nutrient-dense diet, and why is it so important to our health?
Well, the Weston A. Price Foundation diet is an omnivorous diet that's rich in animal foods as well as vegetables, nuts, seeds, and grains. You might say we enjoy all of it, a rich variety of it. And I think it's unfortunate that so many health-conscious people today think the most nutrient-dense foods are vegetables because, in fact, the most nutrient-dense foods in the world are animal foods, particularly organ meats. And animal foods provide all the nutrition we find in plant foods and more. So there's an abundance of vitamins, minerals, and other micronutrients, but also lots of protein and fats, which is what makes them dense in calories. So one of the big problems is when people try to attain such nutritional density from plant foods, they have to eat massive amounts of these foods. And that can be far more than most people would like. For example, to get the protein in a 4-ounce piece of steak, for example, they'd have to eat about 9 cups of spinach. And I think that's more than even Popeye might want to eat.
Dr. Campbell, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that and to get into the studies and the science a little bit more as far as to what led you to the conclusion that the only way to be healthy is to eliminate animal protein altogether.
Yeah, first off, animal foods are not nutrient-rich. I noticed that Daniel referred to protein as being an important nutrient. That's the problem, not the solution. First. Secondly, animal foods have almost no antioxidants. And if there's a class of nutrients that have the most effective, are most effective in preventing disease and creating health, it's the antioxidants. Animal foods may have a little bit if the animal happens to have been eating the plant-based foods prior to their slaughter. So animal foods don't have that. They have too much protein. Protein is a big, big problem. It actually increases cancer and heart disease. That's been known for 100 years. Also, the animal foods don't have any of the complex carbohydrates, which are very important for gastrointestinal health. So the animal foods really, in my view, don't have any nutrients that are not otherwise better obtained from plant-based foods.
Yeah, as I understand from reading your book, Dr. Campbell, you believe that there really isn't a safe level of animal products that we can be eating on a daily basis. Is that right?
Well, the ideal level of protein in a diet is that which is provided by a whole food plant-based diet. That's around 8, 9, 10, maybe 11% protein. And that is actually the number that has been first established as long ago as 75 years ago. And that is reviewed many times since. It's around 12% or so. The plant-based food, that's all that we need. When we start consuming animal-based protein, two things happen. First off, there's a very significant problem with the protein itself. But more to the point, when we consume that kind of food, we tend to displace the kinds of foods we ought to be eating. And so that's basically a double effect in a sense. The protein is causing problems, oftentimes come along with fat. That causes problems as well. And in the process, we decrease the consumption of plant-based foods, and that really makes it a very difficult challenge. Now, some people, of course, can eat more animal protein and animal foods than others. We differ to some extent. But so can some people smoke cigarettes, too, until they're about 90 or 95 years old. And even make a claim they got there because of their smoking cigarettes. That's kind of ridiculous. The number of people that actually can survive that onslaught is really a minor fraction of the population.
So on the one hand, Dr. Campbell, you're saying that animal products are and the protein specifically is the cause of chronic illness. And on the other hand, from Dr. Daniel, as far as I understand it, animal fats specifically, if not the cure, are a key part of healing chronic illness. Is that right, Dr. Daniel?
I think we need whole foods, real foods, and slow foods with all the nutritional variety and density they include, and that those become the healing foods. Those are the foods of our healthy ancestors all over the world. And that's essentially what Mother Nature provided us. And there's not a culture in the world that willingly survives on plant foods alone.
Yeah, so you definitely believe that, you know, animal foods are a crucial part of a healthy diet.
Well, absolutely, and I enjoy my fruits and vegetables too, no doubt about that part.
So if you looked down at a plate, Dr. Daniel, at a dinner plate, I mean, what? How would you divide up your plate? What percentage, you know, should be vegetables? What percentage should be animal-based protein?
Well, that's going to vary from person to person. I would certainly have some animal foods on each of my plates, but I'd also have some good vegetables too. And when I'm enjoying those vegetables, whether it's broccoli or spinach or carrots or whatever, there'd be plenty of butter in there so that the beta carotenes and the lutein and the other micronutrients that are rich in those foods are able to be converted into a form that our bodies can actually use. Because one of the problems with the arguments people have about plant foods being nutritionally dense is that what's there, what's in that food, is not necessarily what we're able to absorb, assimilate, and utilize in the body. And on top of that, many plant foods contain what we call anti-nutrients or toxins. For example, spinach, even if you agree that it contains a whole lot of protein and other good nutrients, that spinach also contains oxalates that contribute to kidney stones. So eating 9 cups of spinach in lieu of eating some animal food, such as a piece of steak, has that potential problem in there. But your question was about the plate, and I would say a varied plate, not just one thing. Some vegetables and some meat, and some people do tolerate grains well, and if they do, fantastic, and you'll improve the nutritional density if you put some of that good bison broth you mentioned in there instead of water.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing, first of all, just some disagreement about even the fundamentals of diet, about what constitutes nutrient dense, how nutrients are absorbed. Isn't science supposed to be the objective third party here? Why is it so hard for us all to agree on the facts? Dr. Campbell, maybe you could start with a little bit of your learnings that you reported in your book, Whole, about how nutritional science is failing us.
Yeah, one of the reasons that there has been so much confusion is because the way we study nutrition and the nutritional properties of foods, we tend to study one nutrient at a time out of context of the whole body. And we can get all kinds of results when we do that kind of thing, misleading results, as a matter of fact. The nutrients should be consumed as foods. We already know, for example, that when we consume nutrients in isolation, as with nutrient supplements, we do not get the health benefits that otherwise might be expected. As a matter of fact, beta-carotene, and I disagree with Dr. Daniels on this, beta-carotene primarily comes from plants. It does not come from liver. And the liver is mostly the retinol derivative beta-carotene. In any case, when there was a study done some years ago now, 20 years ago, a big study comparing people who took beta-carotene from supplements compared to people getting beta-carotene from food. And these were heavy smokers. It turned out the beta-carotene from the supplements actually increased cancer risk, not decreased it. And there's been a lot of studies now showing that. So when nutrients are consumed in isolation, or when we study them in isolation, we get all kinds of interesting products, but they're really irrelevant compared to the whole food. And I don't agree that the oxalate content of spinach causes kidney stones. I know of no evidence showing that spinach causes kidney stones, for example. So I call that process reductionism, and that's what I wrote the book Whole on. It's a very different way of looking at nutrition so that we can get away from this kind of confusion. When we take whole food plant-based diets and we feed them to people, and that's now being done with more and more frequency, they people resolve their problems very quickly. We can cure heart disease, even with people with advanced heart disease. This has been done just brilliantly, that a whole food, plant-based diet with people with heart disease, their heart disease begins to resolve within a matter of weeks. I mean, it's very dramatic. We can actually cure type 2 diabetes with a whole food, plant-based diet, same thing. Type 2 diabetes disappears. I would challenge anyone who happens to be listening to this, if they have a heart problem or if they have a diabetic problem, as well as obesity and a number of other things, just try this diet and they can see what happens. The so-called paleo diet, the Western Price type of diet, cannot do that. The high-protein, high-fat diets, no one has ever done that before. And so the differences are very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. To your point about nutrient absorption, though, I mean, do you think that the nutrients from a plant-based diet can be absorbed without things like meat or oils or, you know, other foods?
Yes. Yeah, that's a perfect example, actually. It turns out that if there's oxalate in some foods and there's some other things sometimes called anti-nutrients or a-nutrients that affect absorption in isolation. In reality, that's the way nature works. Nature works, uses those kind of substances to control the rate of digestion sometimes, the rate of absorption and rate of utilization otherwise. That's part of nature. We study in isolation, of course, we can become alarmed by some of the results we might see. But in reality, if one looks at the content of nutrients in the blood, and the functions of those nutrients upon absorption, the levels consumed in plants are perfect. The body has a capacity to choose how much to absorb at any point in time, or how much to digest, or how much to circulate, and so forth and so on. So and furthermore, the plants have, you know, a very rich supply of all kinds of nutrients, more or less at the right level.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Daniel, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to that now and explain why you think we can't all agree on the facts here.
Well, thank you. I'd first like to say that I did not say that beta-carotene can be found only in animal foods, but I did say that true vitamin A can only be found in animal foods. And most people do need true vitamin A because they're not healthy enough to convert beta-carotene into true vitamin A. And likewise, with the vitamin K1 that we find in lots of the greens, we are usually not able to convert that into the true K2, which is what we need the most. And so it goes with the, say, EFA and DHA fatty acids. Yes, we get lots of omega-3s from the plant foods, but most people are not healthy enough to make the conversion. And there's numerous other deficiencies as well. What we see frequently besides deficiencies of vitamin A, D3, and K2 is B vitamins. Everybody knows about B12. There's also B6 and choline deficiencies, CoQ10 deficiencies, carnitine, iodine, calcium, zinc. It goes on. So, yes, there's a lot of nutrition in plant foods, but there are some missing pieces, and many people are coming up short. But where I would agree with Dr. Campbell is that these studies that are coming out of universities today are really funded by people who can take nutrients and turn them into pills and potions and powders and patent them. So that's giving us information that's very limited. It's all about profits and not about education.
Okay, thank you. Right now we're talking about meat and whether or not to eat it, and if you do eat it, how much. But, you know, you could easily substitute any word for meat. It could be salt, it could be oil, it could be coffee, it could be soy, and we'd be having the same circuitous conversation here, which kind of goes back to the idea that no one can seem to agree on the facts. Dr. Daniel, I think this is a good time for you to share some of the science that you wrote about from the Whole Soy Story.
The Whole Soy Story has a subtitle, The Dark Side of America's Favorite Health Food, and I go into 70 years of studies that link soy consumption to digestive distress, malnutrition, immune system breakdown, reproductive system problems, the development of cancer, and even heart disease. But a lot of people do think that I'm the anti-soy lady, and it's surprising to them that I actually enjoy some soy foods, including old-fashioned fermented miso soup. It's wonderful. So the problems really are with modern industrially processed soy foods that are eaten to excess. A little bit of old-fashioned soy foods once in a while in the context of a rich and varied diet, that's fine, and I enjoy it myself.
Thank you. I find myself thinking back to the dramatic examples that Dr. Campbell just talked about curing heart disease and other diseases in a matter of weeks with a plant-based diet. And, you know, if a cancer patient came into your office, Dr. Campbell, from what I understand, you'd put that person on a strict plant-based diet immediately. And if that same patient walked into Dr. Daniel's office, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Daniel, you'd start that person on a very different diet that would inevitably include animal products. And
well, it would depend on the individual. But the reason that so many people initially do well on plant-based diets is not because they've excluded animal products, but because they've cut way back on heavily processed products, products high in white flour and sugar and hydrogenated vegetable oils and pasteurized milks and many of the really unhealthy products that are a part of the modern diet. And the diet I'm recommending to people would be very nutrient-dense. It would be organic, grass-fed, pastured, free-range. It would be the highest quality animal products and a wide variety of them. And in addition to that, I do agree with Dr. Campbell, there are certain problems with protein, but the protein disagreement I have is with, say, the way some supposedly paleo people will eat only the muscle meats. They're all into steaks and chops. And I'm recommending nose-to-tail eating because the protein we need in our bodies would include the collagen and the gelatin we get from making bone broth out of the carcass of the animals. And we need the organ meats. We need nose-to-tail eating and a variety of high-quality proteins, and that's not factory farm proteins. And by the same token, our vegetables should be organic because there's a lot of problems that we can get from supermarket, pesticide-heavy vegetables and fruits.
I definitely agree that probably one of the largest culprits for most Americans, at least, is processed foods, and we'd all be a lot healthier tomorrow if we stripped those out of our diet. But I think the bottom line here, guys, is that you know, if people felt better on either of these diets, a plant-based diet, a nutrient-dense diet, if we truly were curing heart disease in a matter of weeks and that kind of thing, that the results would be self-motivating enough for people to stick with it. And at least from my perspective, that's not what I see happening out in life. I see people flip-flopping from one philosophy to the next, going from being vegan to vegetarian or vegetarian to eating large quantities of meat or vice versa. Or if not meat, then gluten-free, eat right for your blood type, you name it. It seems like one way of eating solves some problems but not others. Another diet might not be sustainable. So it would appear that people aren't feeling substantially better no matter what they do. And my question to you guys is why? You know, why is that? What advice do you have for people who are trying to take charge of their health and not getting anywhere? Dr. Campbell, we'll hear from you first.
Well, for one thing, and this is very, very sad, there's not a medical school in the United States that teaches nutrition. They have some lectures, but they do not teach nutrition. And I've lectured to at least 150 or close to 200, I think, now medical schools and medical conferences here in the last 4 or 5 years. And finally, quite a lot of doctors now are beginning to switch, you know, their practices, and they're beginning to understand. So the people who are giving us advice, who are giving individual patients advice, these people have had no training in nutrition, and they're willing to admit that in virtually all cases. So that's problem number one. So the at the same time, whether they're practitioners or, in fact, when they're researchers in my community as well, as I said before, they tend to focus on one nutrient or one chemical at a time. That's the basis for the entire pharmaceutical industry, for example. And so there's all that kind of confusion. As far as flip-flopping is concerned, and drawing from what I just said, people really don't understand nutrition very well because doctors don't understand it, first off. Secondly, we're flooded with all kinds of claims being made, especially on the media, coming from various and sundry kind of companies who are obviously looking out for their products. And at the same time, these industries, these food industries and the drug industries, I should say, they have really been seriously interfering in the development of national food and health policy. I know this very well because for about 20 years, I was one of the expert on these expert panels. I testified before Congress. I was on national, being challenged in national audiences, if you will. And I know that the policy that is developed is what in turn gives rise to advertising, gives rise to school lunch programs, for example, gives rise to all kinds of general recommendations from the government. Unfortunately, those recommendations oftentimes are either too moderate to make a difference or, in fact, they're actually in the wrong direction. Because, again, we really don't, as a society, we don't really understand well enough what nutrition can do. I started out my career being raised on a farm and having a high-protein, high-fat diet. I did my graduate work with the idea of promoting higher consumption of protein. But through the years, with lots of students and a lot of projects, I actually saw exactly the opposite of what I myself personally had been doing and what I in fact, was trained. And now I can tell, we've seen just ample examples. So people go on a whole fruit, plant-based diet, all matter of ailments are clarified and cleared up really quite quickly, faster in some people than in other people. Obviously, there's differences, but there's no one that gets worse because of a whole food plant-based diet. If we compare in the short run, we see these dramatic results. You know, low protein, low fat, basically plant-based, that's really what the ticket for good health really is. In the terms of long term, Dr. Daniel mentioned she doesn't know of a society that survived on this kind of diet, but I can tell you that if you look at the compare different countries or different societies with respect to the consumption of fat and protein, versus colon cancer, breast cancer, heart disease, and a few other things. If you compare these countries where people's diets are very stable for the most part, and the countries that have the lowest consumption of protein and fat also have the lowest amount of heart disease and cancer. That's what we saw in China, too. In one case, we had something like 265,000, as I recall, reports were given without a single case of heart disease. And so what I'm basically saying, in the short term, we see these results, and we see the same thing in terms of the long-term results. So it's not true that, it's too difficult to stay on this diet. That's a matter of taste preferences. And if people try this, I should say a whole food plant-based diet without added oil and sugar and salt, if they do that, their taste preferences begin to change. And the first thing you know, people are doing that. It may take 2 or 3 or 4 weeks in some cases, maybe a little longer. The first thing you know, people actually crave a salad instead of the high-fat junk food that they were eating before. I do want to say, though, one thing where I agree with Dr. Daniel, we can find some areas for agreement. Namely, that has to do with the sugar and white flour. Of course, the salt, but the sugar and white flour. I totally agree that the refined carbohydrates are a problem. I think we both would agree to that. But unfortunately, that generalization about carbohydrates being a problem, that's a misstatement. What people should be saying who are concerned about the refined carbohydrates, they should be very specific about that, not talk about total carbohydrates, because the total carbohydrates, which all come from plant-based foods, should be in the native form. That is a, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. Yep, I just want to make sure we give Dr. Daniel time to respond. Dr. Daniel?
Well, there are a lot of issues brought up there. Let me try to run a few by here. People who come to me after being on plant-based diets, they've often read books like the Skinny Bitch books, and it seems very trendy and very fashionable to become vegan. And initially, many of them do start to feel better because they have gone off all those refined carbohydrates. They've cut back on a lot of sugar and so forth. And initially, they feel good. Their skin looks better, and they're very convinced initially. And then things start to go south. And at the point they come to me, their thyroids are down. They're having major reproductive failures. They've got very low energy. They have fierce cravings for sugar and foods that are addictive like that. They're having memory problems, focus problems. And mostly they're just thinking about food all day long because human beings were not designed to graze all day like cows. We've got big brains and little bellies, unlike those big animals that eat plant foods all day and grow up big and strong. So I can't say that I'm seeing people doing well on plant-based diets. Of course, the people who are not going to be calling me up for help. So, you know, that goes with the territory. But again, just to say it again, that I agree with Dr. Campbell on some of these issues, and some of the biggest problems with the standard American diet do have to do with all of these processed and packaged and junk foods and fast foods. And when we start moving towards whole foods of any type, most people do start to do better.
Thank you. I think I'd like to circle back quickly to something, Dr. Danielle, you alluded to earlier on in the conversation, which is that there are no vegan societies historically that we know about, from what I understand. Is that true, Dr. Campbell? I mean, it does seem that the diet you're suggesting, it seems sort of unnatural to human evolution.
Well, if we're talking about 100%, yes, it's difficult to find people who have survived 100%, you know, whole societies, for example. But I know a lot of people who have lived to be quite old, a lot of records of this, when they're consuming 100% plant-based diet, they're very healthy, you know, until the day they pass. But part of the problem, if we look around the world today, we can find a lot of societies that get close to that, maybe not quite 100%. But if one looks at their total diet, not more than, in many cases, you know, just a few percent on average of their diet may be from animal-based foods. And that might be something like yogurt. Occasionally, some societies might rely on a bit of fish. But what we're now learning, as I say, the 100% diet is, for anyone who's got a problem, that they want to take solve their problem with their health, they can essentially be treated by a whole food plant-based diet. It's really quite remarkable. But I have to agree that there aren't, to my knowledge, very many, if any, indigenous groups, I should say, that have survived 100%. I've heard of some, but I haven't personally seen it for myself. Still, the closer we get to a whole food plant-based diet, you know, we see these quite remarkable effects.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we have vegan society now. In the past, it doesn't seem like it. And this is just sort of me speaking off the cuff here from my experience. When I was vegan, it certainly cleared up some major health problems for me. But there were other areas that it sort of left me wanting, mainly energy and trying to get back into exercise. And I guess the sort of conclusion I came into in my mind is that if we all went on a plant-based diet, yes, we would probably reduce our risk of cancer and heart disease and all of these conditions that you speak of, because our toxin threshold would be so low. But I kind of, again, this is just a personal conclusion that I came to for myself, felt that is it possible that our bodies are designed to eat meat, that, you know, we evolved eating meat and that we need it for something, and so that even if our meat supplies are contaminated, if the trade-off is between living a longer life but being cancer and disease-free versus having the energy to live a fuller, richer, but shorter life, that maybe I'd I'd choose the latter option. And I'd like to give you just a quick opportunity to respond to that, Dr. Campbell. I know it's not really a question, but...
Well, just recently, the man who just set a world record in weightlifting is 100% plant-based. The man who just set the world record in the marathon at age 88, again at 90, and then the world record at 92, he's a friend of mine. He's 100% plant-based, and I have actually become acquainted with a number of professional world-class athletes who, when they changed, actually their performance went up. Quicker recovery time if they're in intense exercise, certainly longer endurance time, actually stronger, believe it or not. As I said, this fellow in Toronto just set the world record on that. You have another friend who owns 15 gyms around the world. He's a trainer of professional athletes. And he set world records, national records, I should say, when in his 20s. When he got to his 40s, he went 100% plant-based, and he actually broke some of his records that were set in earlier years. So I really have to disagree. Energy, if it's done right, this is the problem. It really has to be done right. It has to be whole food, plant-based, you know, plenty of hydration, by the way, along the way. Energy, I mean, they're feeling more energetic, not less. I just don't know how that can be true, really.
Dr. Daniel, I'd like to give you a chance to speak to this idea of whether we need meat and how our bodies evolved over time.
I think some people can be healthy vegetarians, but if they're eating high-quality eggs and raw dairy. And I do think that people for a limited time can often benefit from plant-based diets, that it can help them with some detoxing. But long-term, that's not my experience. And in terms of the athletes, there's a lot of disagreement there. There's many, many athletes who do eat an abundance of meat, and that goes way back, and some of them eating too much. And many of the athletes, as they're typically trained, are going very heavily into really poor quality foods, poor quality protein powders, too much of it. So many of them could very conceivably do better, at least for a while, on a plant-based diet. You know, going to real food from powders would be an improvement for sure. But all the top athletes I'm acquainted with are taking bucket loads of supplements, and people on vegan diets who are taking bucket loads of supplements to compensate for the nutrition they're not getting from the plant-based diet can do well for a while, but I certainly prefer real food to a lot of supplements.
Can I make a quick comment on that? I'm not talking about people on a whole food plant-based diet taking supplements. I'm opposed to that. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm using just whole foods. And vegans that I know do not use supplements. So that's a different kind of person.
You know, it's clear to me that the human body is just amazingly complex, far more complex than we are even beginning to understand. And is it possible that the reason why it's so hard to tease out the truth here is because you're both right, and that maybe the adage, everything in moderation, applies. Dr. Campbell, I believe you've said again that, you know, there is no safe amount of animal protein, but, you know, what about a diet that's mostly plants and we treat meat as our condiments?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the last thing you just said. What about the person who is...
I'm just revisiting the idea of everything in moderation, and what about a diet that's, you know, 90% plant-based with limited amounts of animal protein? Can you remind us what the China study said about that?
Well, I should first make some remarks. There's some of us in this field really don't like the idea of moderation, because moderation means different things to different people. If you tell people they can have a few cigarettes and that just in moderation, the first thing you know, it becomes habitual and they start consuming more. So moderation, there's an expression we have, moderation kills. In other words, The idea is, what my view is that the goal on the basis of science, strictly on the basis of science, the goal is 100%. And basically, I honor the step that everybody takes toward that goal. And the closer we get to it, in many cases, they have any kind of health problems, that last 5% is critically important. Because if they continue to have, let's say I'll take 5, 10% a day, all of a sudden they start creeping back to the high-fat, high-protein diet again because an addictive taste, it really is an addiction, fat is. And so I don't subscribe to the moderation idea because, as I say, it's a kind of a slippery slope. If you say a little bit of this, a little bit of that's okay, a little bit of something means something different to a lot of people.
Dr. Daniel, what do you think about the idea of moderation?
Well, I say that a Weston A. Price type diet, or for people who cannot tolerate the dairy or grains, a more paleo diet, that in many ways can be a moderate amount of a lot of different foods, including fruits and vegetables and of course the animal products. And because it can be quite balanced, it can be very satisfying, and people don't go down a slippery slope. They're satisfied and they're satiated. Their taste buds are very, very happy. They feel full. We hear the word nourished a lot. And one of the best things to nourish us well would be broth. And that's something that has been lost from many people on a modern diet. And the fact that broth is now trendy, and I hate that word because it's such an ancestral food, it's been around for thousands of years. But the fact that broth is now fashionable and people are trying it again, what they're saying is, I feel so nourished. I'm not having the cravings. My body and my mind are feeling so happy, like I'm meant to eat this.
I'm not sure, one of you, I'm not sure which, if you could just take a little bit of a step back away from the phone. Your breathing is, we're hearing you breathing. Thank you, Dr. Daniel. Let's see. I wanted to follow up with you, Dr. Daniel, on the idea of toxins being stored in animal fat and meat, and that because of that, that's why we would all be well advised to eat low in the animal chain to minimize the toxins that we ingest. And understanding, as you said, that there's a range of diets that can be nutrient dense with different amounts of vegetables versus meats. But what do you think about this idea that we really need to minimize animal protein as much as possible because of the toxins and fat?
First of all, toxins are also in fruits and vegetables and grains. It's part of the modern world. There's toxicity everywhere, including our water, which is a big source of toxicity. But the fact that it can also be in the animal products is why I so strenuously recommend that we get grass-fed, pastured, free-range, and organic products. And I would recommend that right across the board. If you're eating supermarket fruits and vegetables, your plant-based diet is still a very toxic diet. It's full of pesticides and herbicides and GMOs and other health hazards for sure. So we do need to take care with the source of all of our foods.
Thank you.
Can I comment on that?
Of course. There's been
extensive studies shown, especially with respect to toxic, there's all kinds of toxic chemicals that we can talk about, but some of the most serious are the halogenated or chlorinated, brominated type of compounds. 95% of our consumption of those kinds of toxins comes from animal-based foods, especially fish, because what happens, it's a biological sort of concentration that occurs up through the food chain. That, you know, when animals are eating the plants and they can't metabolize these toxins, they begin to accumulate. That's why the level of toxins in meat is so much higher than it is in plants. It's just simply not true that plants have all these toxic materials in them. I agree, there are the problems concerning GMOs. I don't like that. One has to be somewhat careful, of course, of not using plants that have been recently sprayed with some of the junk that we put on it. But plants can be really quite free of toxins, especially if they're organic.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that, you know, I was on a plant-based diet and didn't quite feel as good as I wanted. And also then I went to a meat diet, and a heavily meat diet, and that was too heavy for me, and landed back somewhere in the middle, which is what I brought back the idea of moderation. When we look at people and what they've been eating the world over, from the Eskimos to cultures who eat more of a plant-based diet, doesn't it indicate that there is no one-size-fits-all diet? And that the right diet depends on your unique biological blueprint? Dr. Campbell?
Well, that's a good question. The differences that we have between us as individuals, or perhaps with respect to the societal groups that we belong to, the differences are that some of us can tolerate some of the difficult foods more readily than other people. But what is common to all of us, regardless of these differences in responsiveness, what is common to all of us really is when a whole food plant-based diet is consumed, that we move in the right direction, so to speak. For many people, if they've got a serious problem, it's basically sparing their life. Other people who are reasonably healthy, some more moderate things kind of occur. You know, cholesterol tends to go down, triglycerides tend to go down, and so forth. So the differences, the individual differences we have is with respect to the degree of responsiveness, not in terms of the direction of the responsiveness. That is, if we consume a whole food plant-based diet, we tend to drift in the direction of a healthier body. More for some people than for other people.
Thank you, Dr. Daniel.
Well, I'd like to mention Dr. Weston A. Price's 1945 book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, because he documented the radiant good health and freedom from chronic disease enjoyed by people eating traditional, nutrient-dense, omnivorous diets that were free of sugar, white flour, pasteurized milk, partially hydrogenated fats, and other modern ingredients. And what a lot of people don't know is that Dr. Price searched the world for a culture in which plant foods without animal products could provide all the requirements of the body for growth and for maintenance of good health. And he found that they did not exist, and it was the greatest disappointment of his life. He wanted to find people succeeding on a plant-based diet, and he did not find that, and he actually found the reverse, that when he found cultures living near each other, some plant-based, some eating the animal foods, the plant-based diet people were doing poorly compared to those on the rich omnivorous diet. So a lot of people don't know that about Dr. Price's work.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah,
I read Dr. Price's book very carefully, underlined it, studied it very carefully. He didn't have a single table in the entire book that had anything to do, really, real data, had anything to do with nutrition and health. He studied 14 indigenous groups in different parts of the world. He was a dentist, and he went to these different parts of the world. I'm sure he was a very well-motivated man, very interested in what he was doing, obviously. But he was studying 14 different groups of people who worked with different kinds of foods. To some extent, that's true. But it was really the dental caries and the dental arches that he was measuring. He showed a lot of photographs in his book. He did not, in fact, have the kind of data that we got in China, for example. I mean, nothing. We had at least 1,000 times more information than what he did. He did not go do that kind of work. That was not his intent. He was interested in looking at dental arches and dental caries as an indication of health. And that was a good survey that he did, because people who hadn't come in contact with the Western world in these places, and there were a number of these people hadn't, they maintained really good teeth, which is a good indicator of health. But as far as the amount of animal food they were consuming. It varied between different groups, but I saw no evidence in that book whatsoever that he was looking for people, you know, vegetarian or, you know, plant-based eaters to see if they were better. I didn't find it. We're reading two different books, I guess.
We're not reading two different books. He wrote more than one book. He wrote a lot of work, a lot of papers, a lot of publications over many years.
Well, you spoke about the physical degeneration. I think, I forget the title of the one that, that I think that was published in 1939, I believe.
45.
I'm going to have to interrupt, guys, because we're running close to the end of our hour. We want to save some time for audience questions. Thank you both for such a spirited and lively discussion. I'm going to turn it back to Priya now so we can hear what questions other people have.
Thank you, Julie. I think that was an amazing discussion. Dr. Campbell and Dr. Daniel, we have a list of questions sent in from our listeners. I am seeing that we have covered quite a bit of the questions in our discussion so far. So I will quickly go over some of the questions. Our first question is for Dr. Campbell. The listener asks, dairy may negatively impact prostate cancer. Do you know if calcium from plants and other non-dairy products need to be tracked when counting the daily 1,200 milligrams of calcium?
I think there's two questions, one having to do with prostate cancer and one having to do with calcium intake. If the questioner is discussing this in the context of the effect of calcium on prostate cancer, yes, it turns out that the higher the consumption of dairy, the higher the risk of prostate cancer. But that's not necessarily just because of the calcium. The evidence tends to suggest it's the protein in the milk itself. In fact, our own work conducted over a period of 27 years with, you know, public money, we demonstrated multiple times over that the most significant chemical carcinogen we consume is the protein in cow's milk. So what people have been now observing, higher prostate cancer, higher dairy. The same as higher dairy, higher osteoporosis as well. But it's not just with respect
Thank
to calcium. It's, yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Dr. Daniel, the next question is for you. Our listener asks, your book, Nourishing Broth, talks about the health benefits of old-fashioned bone broth. Why does broth have the power to heal? And have scientists identified the key healing components?
There have been very, very few studies on broth itself, and one of the reasons for that is there's no profit motive there. But we have many, many studies on components in broth. From the 19th century and early 20th century, many, many studies on gelatin, the collagen component of broth. So there's those studies, and then more recent studies on individual components such as glutamine, glucosamine, chondroitin, the amino acids proline and glycine, which are essential for joint health and actually overall health. Every part of our body needs good proline and glycine, and also glutamine. So we have many, many studies on the components of broth. So that doesn't tell us exactly how much broth or exactly what ingredient should go into the broth when we make it, but I definitely recommend homemade broth with plenty of bones and cartilage and collagen. So it's one way we do nose-to-tail eating. It's what Mother Nature provided for us.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Campbell, the next question is for you. What do you recommend as a sugar substitute for people who cannot eat sugar due to diabetic complications? Stevia, xylitol, erythritol, which of the artificial sweeteners are the safest?
I recommend none. In fact, what I recommend is to try with a little willpower, just get away from the consumption of sugar itself, and it's possible. It's quite easy to do. It may be a little more difficult for some than others, but I don't recommend any sugar substitutes, just the same as not recommending any sugar itself.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Daniel, this question is for you. The person writing in is a nutritionist and says most vegetable oils, canola oil, and even olive oil are processed and refined. These oils have been bleached, deodorized, had chemicals added to increase their fry life. Knowing this, how can we as dietitians recommend these oils as healthy alternatives to butter, ghee, and other cooking fats?
I'm having trouble hearing the question. I gather it's about butter and good old-fashioned fats that I would recommend, like butter and coconut oil, as opposed to industrially processed vegetable oils, which are a known health hazard for any number of reasons. So I recommend going back to what our ancestors did and getting our vegetable fats in the vegetables themselves.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is also for you, Dr. Daniel. For years, we've been told eating red meat is bad for us, and we should only eat it once a week or less. Is that true if you're eating high-quality grass-fed meat?
I think some people benefit from red meat every day. That's not a typical person, and many people, maybe it's once a week. I always do recommend a rich and varied diet, including types of meats. When people are avoiding red meat, they tend to start moving into other things, like perhaps too much fish from contaminated oceans, perhaps too much of the wrong kind of poultry, or worse, some of these plant proteins, such as hemp protein and soy protein and pea protein and substitutes, Father Technologies proteins.
Thank you, Dr. Daniel. Dr. Campbell, the next question is, the U.S. government recently changed its stance on cholesterol, saying that it is not a nutrient of concern for overconsumption. Can you please comment on this?
Yeah, I missed the first your first part of your statement. What was it you're talking about?
The U.S. government recently changed its stance on cholesterol. And it said that cholesterol is not a nutrient of concern for overconsumption.
Yeah, I agree with that recommendation of the U.S. Dietary Guidelines Committee. I know that kind of worked quite well. We have for too long relied on the idea that cholesterol itself causes heart disease, or cholesterol in the food is related to the cholesterol in the blood, when in reality we've known for more than 100 years it's not the cholesterol, it's the animal protein that does that. And there were really some brilliant studies done but ignored showing that when cholesterol was compared with animal protein in terms of its ability to increase cholesterol in the blood and subsequently to develop atherogenesis, that's the early stage of heart disease, it's the animal protein that does that. It's not the cholesterol. So I've always been troubled with the idea that we focus too much on cholesterol. It's a reductionist idea. It's out of context. But by the same token, when we have cholesterol in the food, then we're consuming animal-based foods. So cholesterol turns out to be a marker of the kind of food we're eating. It's not related to the cholesterol causing the disease. We need to clarify that relationship.
Thank you, Dr. Campbell. We are almost at the end of our hour now. That was a wonderful, great, I would say very enlightening discussion. Dr. Campbell and Dr. Daniel, it was an honor to have you here with us and a pleasure to listen to you. Julie, you are wonderful. Thank you so much. The recorded broadcast will be available on CureTalk's website along with the transcript. Please visit curetalks.com for our upcoming shows. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you, Priya. Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Campbell.
You so
Dr.
Much.
Daniel.
And thank you, Dr. Daniels.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.